When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.
HD Smartcast. You're listening to a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Welcome to HD's A View from the Stands podcast, a series in which we'll discuss everything sports in the time of absolutely no sports. I'm Aditya Iyer, and with me is the national sports editor of Hindustan Times, Rudraneel Sengupta.
Rohit Brijnath, a writer that you and I both adore, once told me that Netflix has waged a war against his reading time and Netflix is winning by a landslide. I really hope for Brijnath's sake and for yours and for our listeners that during this lockdown, we managed to find the time to at least dust off some classics and get down to reading. And because our podcast is about sports, this episode is going to be about sports content in the form of books. Let's begin with you, Rudra. What have you been reading or rereading, if that's the case?
I'm reading a lot. I'm knee-deep in books, not all of them sports books, but I'm reading a lot. And I wish Rohit Brijnath would stop watching Netflix, not just so that he could read, but also so he could write his next book, which at least I have been waiting for a long time now.
That's right. After the Bindra one, right?
That's right. After Bindra's wonderful autobiography, he promised that he would write another one, and we're still waiting.
Yeah.
But talking about sports books, I mean, I am an Arsenal fan, so any points for getting what book I'm going to start with?
Fever Pitch, Nick Hornby, boss.
10 points to you. Is this like a highly personal book about one man's obsession with Arsenal, or is this the greatest sports book ever written? I can't decide. I mean, are you an Arsenal fan?
No, I'm not. This is totally an acquired taste. But I've read the book and I really enjoyed it. So please go on.
Okay. So it's the greatest sports book ever written. So, Nick Hornby, this is a book about his, I mean, it's already clear, this is a book about his obsession with the Arsenal football team.
That's right.
An obsession that I sort of share. I am not at Nick Hornby's level, but, you know, I am an Arsenal fan myself. And the thing that he brings out so beautifully in this book, it's a very funny book, but it's also sometimes very sad, is how to love a sporting team is to know kind of like this constant disappointment, you know, this like dull ache of suffering.
Yeah, I think he totally celebrates that, right?
He celebrates that, and being an Arsenal fan right now is, I started watching Arsenal when they were at their ascendancy, you know, they were going towards their great invincible season and all of that. So, that's when I actually got hooked, and ever since then, I've been hooked since then, but they have never reached those heights again, and so it has been a dull ache of suffering and constant disappointment for me, and I'm not sure I can celebrated the way that Hornby has, and
that's right.
An example of the kind of obsession with football. Hornby writes in his book, he's 15 years old and he sees his first dead body, which is this Crystal Palace fan who suffered a heart attack, and he's lying on the pavement and he's dead. And Hornby walks past and the thought that comes to him is that, and he writes, this is quote-unquote, he writes, it worries me the prospect of dying in mid-season like that.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine? It's not the death, it's about when in the season has this occurred. Have you finished watching the season or not? That's what's more important than life and death.
That was the first thought that crossed his mind.
Yeah, that's fever pitch for you.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to stick with football as well as my first pick. And it's also an acquired taste because it's on Italian football, which is very similar to what you Arsenal guys feel about Arsenal. I mean, it's really not for everyone, but I'm guessing the one shining star of this really defensive play and mindset that came out of the late 90s and the early 2000s was Andrea Pirlo. And this is his autobiography, which I think, again, I mean, we're throwing this term around quite, you know, easily right now, but I think it's the greatest autobiography ever written, and it's dry.
You mean a greatest sports autobiography?
Greatest sports autobiography. I mean, greatest autobiography, man. I mean, it okay. Could really be a cross-genre.
We're just going for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think a lot of credit has to be given to his translator, Alessandro Alciato, because he's managed to get the essence of everything that was written in Italian and the essence of Pirlo, which is, you know, his writing is a lot like his football. It's dry and somehow flamboyant at the same time. And everything he speaks about, he talks about what's happened in the dressing room during the 2006 World Cup campaign, which they won. You know, no holds barred. He talks about Inzaghi's love for these weird biscuits that only he would eat. And everyone would hate him eating it because he would take like a massive shit immediately after eating it and just before they had to go out on the field. And anytime they would see people in Zaghi with, you know, that packet of biscuits, all these guys would groan in unison. So, I mean, fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. That would be my autobiography of not just this lockdown, but life. Do you have any autobiographies?
How deeply does it go into his playing philosophy? I mean, is there something? I mean, I haven't read it, but I would love to know more about the way his vision worked on the field. For example, the way he found people.
That's right.
You know, the footballing mind of
his. He approaches it tangentially because he talks about his love for Guardiola while playing in AC Milan. And he was like, he and his pal Alessandro Nesta would do is they would get to the dressing room in the San Siro and sit in front of their PlayStation. And both of them would want to be Barcelona because it was run by Guardiola. And both of them would want to play the Barcelona way. And it really shows you that Pirlo was, you know, the most non-Italian of Italian footballers of that time, right? Because I think he understood the tiki-taka better than most. He almost signed for Barcelona as well. But he was different. And everything he writes, it's totally not from that generation of Italian footballers. Yeah, so that brings me back to the question that I'll ask you before you ask me about Pirlo, which is, are there any autobiographies that you have in mind?
Oh, yeah, of course. And first one that comes to mind, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to call it the best autobiography ever written.
Okay, that's Pirlo's boss.
It is certainly the most passionately anti-sports book written by an athlete. And
okay.
That's Andre Agassi's Open.
Ah, fabulous.
Fabulous autobiography. Again, a lot of credit goes to, of course, the person he co-wrote with whose name I can't remember right now. But it really brings out the flavor of being an elite athlete, the life of an elite athlete, and actually being a sports person in a sport which you hate, which is something that is so rare for a non-athlete to know about. It's a world that I wouldn't have known if I did not read Open. I would have no idea about how much Agassi actually hated what he was doing, but he, you know, and the way his life was structured, it was like being in prison all the time. It was And that's what he says. It was the prison cell of his own backyard where his father, when he was 6 or 7 years old, had this tennis machine set up which would throw balls at like 150 kilometers per hour at him.
He had a name for it, no? The demon or something like that.
Yeah, there was a name for it, but I don't remember it.
Yeah, but the demon really is Mike Agassi in this case.
Yes, that's right. And represented by the machine that's spewing 2,500 balls per day at a six-year-old kid who has to, you know, return those balls, which is, I mean, and you see Agassi in his playing days, the way he could return just about anything, and you see where it comes from, but also the pain that's involved in acquiring that skill. And Agassi spent most of his life in a kind of prison. And from his home, which he describes as a prison, Agassi then goes on to Nick Bollettieri's tennis academy, which he again describes as a glorified prison camp. So there's no wonder that this kind of bitter experience that he has makes him into a rebel, which is what we see from the outside, this, like, you know, guy with this crazy hair, wearing very, very colorful clothes, you know, rebelling against the traditions of Wimbledon, for example, and the bad boy of tennis.
Image is everything fails.
Yeah, right, that's right. So what there is an arc in Open that is the redemption, where he sort of discovers pretty late in his career an actual love for the game that he has hated all his life. Right, and this is when he actually starts really succeeding on the tennis stage, and also the major part of this redemptive arc is Steffi Graf, his marriage to Steffi Graf.
That's right.
And he describes as a person who equally hates tennis, but is much more disciplined and much more driven than he ever has been. And then the two of them, you know, find like partners who can understand each other really.
That's right.
And, so I love Open for the insight it gives into both the world of tennis, the game itself, the art of strategy and tactics and the nuances of playing.
Yeah.
And also the mind of an athlete, a mind as colorful as tormented as Agassi's.
As Agassi's, that's very well put. And I will stick to tennis with my second pick as well, but this is the opposite end of hating the game, it's actually loving it. It's by the Sports Illustrated writer John Wertheim, and it's his 2008 classic on the 2008 classic match. The final between Federer and Nadal, I mean, you'd have to be living under a rock to not have watched it or heard about it at least. But he makes it. What a match, exactly. And what a book too. It's called Strokes of Genius. And he's written 5 chapters, and each chapter is a set. And it starts with the ball being tossed up into the thin London air, and it ends with Nadal and Federer shaking hands at the nets in near darkness, right? This is the last year that Wimbledon was played without a roof. A final was played without the roof. And what a book. I mean, he has described every single point in the match, but it's the way he's done it. You know, he'd talk about Nadal's running down the line forehand, and then he put a full stop there, and then take you back to Manacor and Mallorca and talk about how that skill was developed, and do the same with Federer and Basel. And, you know, it's this to and fro motion in the book, along with this very simple and beautiful narrative of the final itself. I mean, absolutely incredible. I mean, if you want to chronicle a great event, I think that would perhaps be the way to do it. Do you have any favorites when it comes to, books written on just events that were bigger than sport itself, no? Like this 2008 Wimbledon final, and where a writer either captured it or didn't capture it, but gave it a shot. Have you read any of those?
Well, I mean, the book that comes to mind is, unfortunately, a book I don't like. It's called The Fight by Norman Mailer. And of course, it's a...
I see.
just the event that it captures.
Yeah.
Muhammad Ali fighting George Foreman in Congo. Like, what could be bigger? Like, this is like the absolute wet dream for any sport fighter to be able to ride on an event as big as
this. Right.
It just does not get bigger or more atmospheric or more crazy than Rumble in the Jungle.
Yeah.
Right? And Mayweather gets incredible access. Muhammad Ali's entourage loves him. So he's always there, he's always hanging out, and what I don't like about it is, one, that he puts too much of himself in the book. It's
okay.
Too much about him when...
But he was present, what do you mean? I mean, he was one of those eight journalists who were there.
I know he was present, but like, even Bob, look at the thing, it's much bigger than you, and this is, George Foreman. And also the very overwrought style of writing that really gets away sometimes. It's like a very poor imitation of Ernest Hemingway or Vladimir Nabokov. You know, trying to, I don't know what he's trying to do. I mean, can I just, I have the book in front of me.
Okay.
I would like to read out for humor's sake.
Excellent.
The opening lines of
I'm sorry, before you do that, I just want to put this out there that I absolutely love the book and I love Norman Mailer.
I'm taking down one of your icons, man.
Yeah, man.
But this is what it says. There is always a shock in seeing him again. Sorry, not live as in television, but standing before you looking his best. Women draw an audible breath. Men look down, and the down is italicized.
Yeah.
They are reminded again of their lack of worth. If Ali never opened his mouth to quiver the jellies of public opinion, he would still inspire love and hate. For he is the prince of heaven, closest to silence around his body when he is luminous. I mean, I cannot give you a worse example of overwrought writing.
I really like it, man. I do. I really do.
You were enemy for life.
Okay, so that was the fight by Norman Mailer. The next one, my pick G, that was your third pick. My third pick remains in 1974. Wasn't Rumble in the Jungle in 1974?
That's right, yeah.
It was. Okay, fine. So this book that I'm going to talk about by David Peace called The Damned United is also set in 1974, but not in Africa. Have you read it?
Yes, I have.
Absolutely fabulous. Yeah, I agree. It's a very rare book to find, but I have a story on that too. Let me just give a quick synopsis, which is it's on Brian Clough, but not the way you know Clough, not during his glory days with Nottingham Forest. But he's now, the story begins with him as a lowly manager at Derby County, and he gets them from First Division to top flight football, and he's absolutely in love with Leeds United like everybody else in England at this point. Because it's the big team at that point. And this book called The Damned United is about his 44 days in charge of Leeds that did not go the way Clough wanted or the management or this character that looms large over the book called Don Revy, who was the manager of Leeds for 14-odd years. And the players are all still, they absolutely worship him and not Clough. And these are about the 44 worst days of his life. And the writer, who's David Peace, hasn't really, written about Clough in the best of ways, and it didn't go down too well with the Clough estate. So, the book is not really an injunction, but the book didn't, I think copies were very hard to find and stuff like that. And
right,
it was written just after Clough's death. I think Clough died in the early 2000s, and this was written in 2003 or 4. And one fine day, a few years back, I was walking around, the the second-hand bookstore in Saket Anupam, and there the book was. And, you know, it wasn't one of those Xerox copies books. It was the original. It was right there, and it said, like, if you, at the back, instead of a blurb, it says, if you manage to get your hands on this book, please keep it. Or if you don't want to keep it, please don't give it. I mean, give it away to a friend, give it away to a loved one. So I think they knew its value, and I found it in a second-hand bookstore.
Amazing. Just for that blurb, you know, that it's worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think we should now get back to reading.
Exactly. So that's it for this episode, folks. Thank you for tuning in, and more of it next time.
This was an episode of A View from the Stands. Do like and follow us on at HT Smartcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or write to us on podcasts@hindustantimes.com. You can listen to more podcasts by logging on to htsmartcast.com.
This was a Hindustan Times production, brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.